of them somewhere, but here's an example. On 27631, November 4th at 1010, the Church of the Assumption in Tullamore, County Offaly. All this came via shortwave.
And the radio is in the hands of such a lot of fools trying to anesthetize the way that you feel. Radio is a sound salvation. Hi, it's Holly Tanner.
And Justin Weaver.
We're from Something to Talk About, and you're listening to 90.7 FM.
WGXC, Acre, Catskill, and Hudson.
Yep, you're listening to WGXC 90.7. And when I'm coming home from the turnip picking, I like to listen to the Battlefield Earth program. Boy, that guy's got some sensibility about him, doesn't he? Every Tuesday nights at 9:30. It's crazy out there.
You can find out about so many local events, like the traditional Irish music session. Every Sunday, there's an open Irish music jam at the Shamrock House in East Durham from 2 to 5 p.m. Find out more on the WGXC community calendar online at WGXC.org and add your own event to the WGXC community calendar and have it read on the radio at 90.7 FM by going to WGXC.org and clicking on the community calendar.
WGXC underwriting support is provided in part by Upstate Films, featuring first-run and repertory films at movie theaters located in Rhinebeck and Saugerties, as well as live music, filmmaker conversations, staged readings, community events, variety shows, magic, comedy, and more. The latest schedules, as well as upcoming pop-up events at the community theater in Catskill, can be found at upstatefilms.org.
WGXC is made possible in part by the generous ongoing support of Cochrane Media of Cairo, New York. WGXC's sustaining supporters are among the station's most dedicated listeners. They care deeply about creative community radio, and their investment helps to sustain WGXC as a public platform for information, experimentation, and engagement in Greene and Columbia counties. You too can become a sustaining supporter by going to wgxc.org/donate. Thank you for your support.
WGXC helps you sleep at night and stay awake in the daytime. Whether at work or play, in good times and in bad, no matter the weather, community radio brings you local news, agricultural information, music and sounds, oratory, and Radio Stews.
90.7 FM, WGXC.
From the WGXC newsroom, this is the WGXC News Update. Jamal Cutler reports for Columbia Green Media that six projects in Columbia County won $5.6 million of more than $57 million of New York's latest Regional Economic Development Council Initiative Awards. F. Michael Tucker, President and CEO of the Columbia Economic Development Corporation, said, and I quote, "Columbia County did really well. We're very grateful to the governor's office considering projects in Columbia County and awarding funds to the individual project sponsors to advance economic opportunities in Columbia County," end quote. Montgomery Street projects in Hudson received $1,526,168 for rehabilitation of the Katz Building. The Hudson Athens Lighthouse Preservation Society gets $500,000 to fix the underwater foundation of the lighthouse. Friends of the Public Square Hudson receives $500,000 for renovation. The town of New Lebanon got $500,000 for improvements to Shafford Memorial Park and $25,000 for a public utilities project. Clock Estate of Kinderhook received $275,000 for tourism events, and Hudson Hall gets $70,650 for the Hudson Jazz Festival. Read more about this story at HudsonValley360.com. Tiffany Greenwald Simon reports for Columbia Green Media that there will be better cell service soon on Farm to Market Road in Coxsackie after the town's planning board approved a new tower on November 14th, a silo. The 136-foot-high tower will look like a silo behind 20 12-foot-high evergreen trees. Planning Board Chair Scott Fisher said the town code meant a cell tower is allowed to be built. Fisher said, and I quote, "My vote is not for the cell tower. My vote is that if we say no, we lose our destiny in what this cell tower will look like," end quote. The tower passed the planning board 5-1, with Gerald Bunting opposing all three resolutions that needed approval. He said he was lodging a protest vote and said, and I quote, "The basis of our economy here is tourism. People come here for the scenery. They don't come here for telecoms. This is going to have a serious effect on property values, not just to the immediate residents, but residents further away, because the overall value of the area is going to be negatively impacted. I understand why this needed to pass, but it can't be unanimous," end quote. Read more about this story at HudsonValley360.com. There are signs locally that winter is approaching. The village of Catskill this week hung holiday lights and took down the statue of Rip Van Winkle at the top of Main Street for the winter so that it is not hit by snowplows. After opening early on November 16th and 17th for the area's first skiing, Bel Air Mountain closed again and will open for the season on November 24th. Windham Mountain's website does not hint when it will start skiing, and Hunter Mountain's website also does not say when it will open and reports no snowfall yet this season. And that wraps up the WGXE News Update. You can visit our website at WGXE.org for local weather updates, public meetings, a community calendar, or COVID-19 updates. And while you're there, please click on the donate button to become a WGXE sustaining supporter or make a one-time donation. From the WGXE newsroom, I'm Philip Grant. Have a good day and a nice weekend.
The Undressed Wounds of Gaza. I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! With Dennis Moynihan in our weekly Breaking the Sound Barrier podcast. M. Berry recently published a poem, Because of Us, that reads, "This morning I learned the English word gauze, finely woven medical cloth, comes from the Arabic word Gaza, because Gazans have been skilled weavers for centuries. I wondered then, how many of our wounds have been dressed because of them, and how many of theirs have been left open because of us?" M. Berry's poem is painfully timely as the Israeli military, after weeks of bombing civilian targets, including schools, hospitals, and ambulances, has expanded its ground invasion, attacking hospitals directly with tanks and troops. According to the World Health Organization, the WHO, 26 of Gaza's 36 hospitals are non-functional, denied electricity, fuel, supplies, and damaged by Israel's assault. Inoperable incubators, respirators, and dialysis machines have left patients to die. Staff trapped at Al-Shifa, Gaza's largest hospital, dug a mass grave to bury over 180 dead patients. Israel's also killed an estimated 200 medical workers, among them Dr. Hamam Alo, a 36-year-old internist and nephrologist at Al-Shifa, killed along with his father, his father-in-law, and brother-in-law on Saturday, November 11th, when Israel shelled his home. He survived by his wife and two young children. Dr. Alo spoke on the Democracy Now! NewsHour on October 31st, 2 weeks before his death.
The few trucks that were allowed in with aid to Gazan people actually is almost nothing compared to what we need. And there was many of the contents of these trucks that were allowed into Gaza had water, gloves, and gauze, and this is not what we are looking for. We are looking for devices, medications, things of really major help and concern for providing real health care for people in need.
Days earlier, Dr. Allo made an excruciating decision, ordering his staff to stop resuscitating an older patient as the hospital lacked a working ventilator for her, so even if successfully resuscitated, the patient would still die. He instructed the doctors and nurses to triage care, saving those with a chance of survival. Despite Israel's constant bombardment and approaching ground invasion, Dr. Allo refused to leave.
If I go, who treats my patients? They are not animals. They have the right to receive proper health care.
Doctor,
so we can't just leave. You think I went to medical school and for my postgraduate degrees for a total of 14 years, so I think only about my life and not my patients?
That brave decision cost Dr. Hammam Allo his life. A family member wrote Democracy Now! Saying his body remains buried under rubble. Al-Shifa, meanwhile, has become a war zone.
If I should choose today between hell and Shifa, I would choose hell.
Dr. Mads Gilbert, a Norwegian physician with decades of experience in Gaza, said on Democracy Now! He tried repeatedly to get into Gaza in recent weeks to get to Al-Shifa without success.
I got a report yesterday from the Minister of Health that 20 out of the 23 ICU patients had died. 17 other patients died because of lack of supplies, oxygen, and water. And three, if not five, of the 38 premature newborns have died because of this slow suffocation that Israeli occupation army is exposing all the hospitals to by cutting electricity, oxygen, and medical supplies. And it's beyond description. I'm out of words to describe this systematic man-made slaughtering of patients in civilian hospitals.
While words may fail Dr. Mads Gilbert, those of the late Dr. Hammam Allo on Democracy Now! Offer a posthumous call to action.
We need this war to end because we are real humans. We are no animals. We have the right to live freely. We are being exterminated. We are being massively eradicated. And you pretend to care for humanitarian and human rights, which is not what we are living now. To prove us wrong, please do something.
At least 1.6 million Palestinians have been displaced by Israel's war on Gaza out of the enclave's population of 2.3 million. Earlier this week, Israel dropped leaflets on the southern Gaza city of Khan Yunis, warning residents to flee, many for the second time after fleeing northern Gaza. The United Nations Security Council passed its first resolution Wednesday after four previous failed attempts calling for extended humanitarian pauses in Gaza, with the United States abstaining. Israel, well known for ignoring UN resolutions, will likely ignore this one, too. The late Palestinian poet Mahmoud Darwish, as a child, survived the 1948 Nakba, Arabic for catastrophe, when 750,000 Palestinians were driven from their homes and 15,000 were killed during Israel's founding. Darwish lived much of his life in exile. He was a critic of Hamas. He wrote in his poem to a young poet, "A poem in a difficult time is beautiful flowers in a cemetery." As the WHO warns, Gaza's hospitals are becoming cemeteries. It's time to heed the poets and the doctors, stop the killing, end the occupation, and dress the open wounds of war. I'm Amy Goodman with Dennis Moynihan.
The National Weather Service in Albany says an upper-level disturbance and cold front comes through the Hudson Valley on Sunday with some scattered rain and snow showers at higher elevations. Then the week will have tranquil conditions until a storm system could lead to some wintry precipitation and locally heavy rain in the middle of the week. Sunday, the forecast is for rain showers between 1 and 5 p.m. Otherwise, it'll be mostly sunny with a high of 45 and a west wind 7 to to 14 miles per hour spinning local windmills. On Sunday, it should be partly cloudy with a low around 26 and a northwest wind at 10 to 13 miles per hour. Monday should be sunny with a high of just 36 and a north wind 7 to 10 miles per hour spinning those windmills. Monday night should be partly cloudy with a low around 21. Then Tuesday, there's a chance of rain and snow after 2 p.m. Otherwise, it'll be partly sunny with a high of 37. 40% chance of some sort of precipitation falling. Tuesday night, it rises to 100%. Rain and snow showers are forecast, becoming all rain after 10 p.m. with a low around 32. You're listening to the radio, WGXC 90.7 FM, Acre, Catskill, Hudson, solar-powered radio for open ears.
If people don't know, Bill Fletcher is one of the most significant Black freedom fighters in this era, and his era spans the 20th century into the 21st. When I talk about you, Bill, I always mention that you were president of the Trans-Africa Forum, which was one of the most significant anti-apartheid organizations in the United States during the era of apartheid. So whenever we can get Bill Fletcher to come to our capital region, we're very happy about that. And Bill and I work together in the Ukraine Solidarity Network, which is a national organization. So we got to be reunited after having known each other for a number of years. So that was something that we really wanted to have and be able to share.
For you, Bill, I'd like you to tell us a little bit about why the Ukraine Solidarity Movement was important to you and how you think it fits in with your other work.
Ukraine work is important on multiple, least of which is that the pretext used by the Russians to invade Ukraine really mirrored those that were used by George W. Bush to invade Iraq. And that was one of the things that struck me immediately. Second was that Ukraine has a colonial heritage vis-a-vis Russia. That is, it was dominated as, in effect, a colony by Russia for centuries. And even though, ironically, the Russian state originated in what is now Ukraine, Russia came to dominate as part of the building of its empire. It came to dominate Ukraine. So in that sense, Ukraine shares much with most of the rest of the world, which has been victims of colonialism. And so that also affected me. A third thing is my great fear of the Putin regime specifically and the growth of global right-wing authoritarianism generally. And when you look at the relationship that Putin has had with Trump, for example, and growing segments of the Republican Party, you see that much like in the pre-World War II situation in the United States, there are segments of the political right that are more than willing to not only give a pass, but to advocate in favor of right-wing authoritarian movements in Europe and in some other parts of the world. And I think that that's what we're seeing.
My next question is about the post-October 7th environment. There's so many parallels here, issues of occupation, but also the way that these have created some real splits in the American public, although it seems from a distance at least that this country comes down on the opposite side on these two conflicts.
The United States does not have a very good history of being on the right side of history, but every so often they are, like in World War II. In the lead up to World War II, there were movements that were saying to the United States government that with the advance of fascism, the United States needed to take a clear and unequivocal stand. And when the Spanish Civil War erupted in 1936, these movements insisted that the United States should militarily support the Spanish government against the fascist uprising and a direct intervention by the Germans and Italians. That was the correct stand. So one general principle is that when there is aggression, we should be on the right side of history.
There's obviously so much here, and that's okay, because if people want to go deeper in this issue, you guys will be at the Albany Public Library at 11 a.m. on Saturday.
The Washington Avenue branch, what is referred to as the main branch.
You'll be able to go much deeper into these issues then. If I could just have one last question. You both have an incredibly rich, long history, specifically in speaking to the issues of oppressed people. So can you boil down, like, how do you determine in these type of situations who are the oppressed people? Because everybody has sort of mastered some of this language in both directions. And, you know,
well, I think what's really important about the work that we've been doing on Ukraine is that we listen to the people who actually are dealing with the situation on the ground from the bottom up. And that's another way to think about political work, instead of looking at what governments are doing and from the top down, because it seems like governments tend to make big mistakes. The United States' relationship to Ukraine and to Israel and Palestine and et cetera, and Russia, all of those countries that the United States is playing on the table with, it's consistent. It's consistent because the United States is looking out for what it sees as its capitalist interests, its economic interests, its power domination interests. They see themselves lining up against Russia so that Russia does not outdistance them in the race for world hegemony. And then as far as Israel is concerned, they're siding with the people who they see as having similar interests to theirs in that region. And that includes economic interests as well. So we listen to Ukrainians, we listen to Russian dissidents, we listen to Palestinians, and we listen to Israelis who oppose the occupation. So that's what we do.
Let me add to that. See, I think this is why history is so important. And the problem is, in the United States, we actively oppose history and we embrace myth. So that then leads people to start stories wherever they want to start the story, because they don't feel bound to any real understanding of history. I mean, if you want to look at the current situation in the Middle East, you don't go back 2,000 years. That's a myth. You go back to the 1800s, and you start with the development of a Zionist movement in Europe that was in direct response to the absolute hatred that European Christians have had towards Jews since the Roman Empire. And you look at the Zionist movement as a movement that was providing a particular pro-imperial solution to how they perceived anti-Semitism playing out. And that solution necessitated aligning the Zionist movement with imperial powers. So the root of this crisis does not start October 7th. And that's the problem. When you start the story midway, and this is true if you're watching a film or reading a book, you start the story in the middle, you can't figure out really what's going on. And so for much of the U.S. public, what they're exposed to in the media is October 7th, Hamas committed a war crime in launching this attack. And it's true. There was a war crime in attacking civilians, not the military side, but simply, you know, going after civilians was a war crime by international law. No question about it. Now, having said that, did that come out of nowhere? Did that just sort of pop up? No. It has to be understood in the context of Gaza being the largest open-air prison on this planet. But that has to be understood in terms of the implications from the 1967 war, which itself has to be understood from the implications of the 1948 war, which itself has to be understood from the implications of the way that the 1947 partition of Palestine was carried out without the input of Arabs. I mean, this is what I think people in the United States got to get. Arabs were not involved in dividing up of Palestine. It was carried out by Europeans. So when people wonder why the Palestinians are upset, I mean, they had a chance. Well, wait a minute now. This was done on their heads. It was done over them. So why shouldn't they be furious? So you can't look at what we're seeing right now in Gaza by just going back to October 7th. It's completely misleading. But see, it's the easy way. And the U.S. media, with all due respect, likes to hit the easy button. And therein lies the problem. So to understand, go with history.
Your quote that the U.S. embraces myth and ignores history is a pull quote for sure. That's pretty powerful.
It's not that it ignores history. It opposes history.
It opposes, wow.
That's very important. That when things get in the way, as we see now in the debates around so-called critical race theory, when the facts get in the way of the myth, you get rid of the facts.
I don't know how you guys feel about the shape of the world these days, but you know this guy Donald Trump? You heard this? People talk about him a lot, and because people are talking about him, we talk about him, like, say, the 91 charges he's facing, which is, technically speaking, and I don't want to get into the legal jargon here, that's a lot. That's a lot of charges. But it has, as much as all of us talk and think about this numbnut, every so often, it's really important with this guy, it's important to, let's say, metaphorically, jam the sharpened stick of knowledge into the soft inner thigh of your mind and just grind it around a little bit to try to reawaken the horror of what our country would be like if this hate-filled dingus and his soulless goons ever got a hold of power again. Because, and I don't know if you've noticed, but Donald Trump is a fascist. Too harsh, you say? Fine. But consider this, my friends. Over the past week, Trump has repeatedly compared his political opponents to vermin who he will root out. First, okay, that's dehumanizing his fellow Americans. Second, if he's really looking for vermin, he should start with his own lawyer, who I believe is an alcoholic mole rat. Okay. Now, further, my friends, if the word vermin has a hint of Himmler to you, well spotted, because according to the Washington Post, Trump has long toyed with the language of fascists, but is now echoing dictators like Hitler and Mussolini. Yes, some in the media are starting to suspect that the guy who sent a violent mob to murder his vice president so he could stay in power might have a dark side. Yesterday, Trump's campaign pushed back on this comparison to jackbooted dictators with this reassuring statement. Those who try to make that ridiculous assertion are clearly snowflakes grasping for anything, and their entire existence will be crushed when President Trump returns to the White House. Furthermore, anyone who says I'm a cannibal is a liar, and if they say it again, I will eat their delicious face. You'd look pretty good on a bun, buddy. Now, naturally, this spokesman's initial statement there was perceived as a bit extreme. So the spokesman, and this is real, later clarified that instead of crushing their entire existence, he meant to say their sad, miserable existence. So less of a walk it back and more of a goose step it forward. Here's another thing that fascists enjoy doing. They cling to power after the voters reject them. That's what Trump is on trial for in Georgia, where prosecutors have gotten multiple Trump associates to plead guilty, including former Trump attorney and school parent explaining why the very hungry caterpillar is homosexual agenda. Jenna Ellis. Last night, video leaked of Ellis revealing to prosecutors that in the December of 2020, a Trump White House aide told her that even though the lawyers were telling Trump that he definitely lost, quote, the boss is not going to leave. Thanks to Jonathan Carl's new book, we're also learning more about Trump's belief in some of the weirder QAnon theories that have percolated out there. For instance, back in 2021, the Q folks were all saying that Trump would be reinstated on August 13th, 2021, as part of the so-called storm, when Trump would expose the cabal of Satan-worshipping pedophile elites and declare martial law, meaning he would remain in power and conduct mass arrests and executions of top Democrats or other supposed members of the cabal. Oh, 2021. It was a crazy time. Of course, since then, most of the more insane believers in that nonsense have been sentenced to Congress. But it turns out Turns out it wasn't just your aunt on Facebook who bought into Q, because that summer Trump was telling people that he expected he would get reinstated by August. Come on, cult leaders.